Thank you, members. Let me then officially open the meeting and welcome all members of the Portfolio Committee who are here, and also welcome the delegation from the South African Police Service. Welcome the delegation from the Independent Police Investigative Directorate, IPID, and further welcome the civil society organizations that are here with us to make input in today's deliberations. Welcome the media, welcome a public representatives that are here just to hear what we are saying. Maybe before we start with the topic at hand, let me say here that we learnt with shock yesterday about the murder of Honorable Bishop Dolo, who was murdered in the early hours of the morning yesterday. Such left us shocked, hurt, mourning, and very angry. I really mean that we are a nation in mourning here in Parliament. I personally believe that Honorable Dolo did not deserve to die like this. He was a very kind person, a very gentleman person, and a very humble person. We, as the members of the Portfolio Committee on Police, I think we have to call upon the SAPS to do everything to ensure that these people responsible for this act, which I believe it is a real devilish act, are brought to book. For me, it's not just about the arrest of those people, but I also believe that it should also be about a case that must definitely be watertight so that they can be found guilty and be sent to the place where they belong. It will be unfortunate, and it remains unfortunate, that we have a situation where even if you are in your own home, people break into your home and they kill you where you think you are most safe. We want to extend our sincere and heartfelt condolences to the family of Bishop Dolo, to the friends, to the neighbors, and to the people of Sekukune, that rural area in the Limpopo province, and of course to all of us. And maybe here I will request that we just stand up and observe a moment of silence in memory of Bishop Dolo. May his soul rest in peace. Thank you. It is becoming a trend that each week we learn of one or two SAPS members who are being killed. Like it has happened in the past weeks, and even this week it has again happened. I think this is one thing that as a nation we should look into seriously, because it just cannot happen in a country that members who are expected and supposed to defend all of us are the ones who are killed, as it is happening right now. We will also want to extend our sincere condolences to families of those that have been killed lately, and particularly this week. Going back to the topic for today, which, as it was sent out, I really want to thank the civil organizations that are here who showed interest in our work here in Parliament and out of their own initiative requested to be part of this, and there's no way would not have accepted it because we believe that this is a people's parliament. We will therefore have to move very fast with our presentations because as a matter of fact, we are to be here from now until 1 o'clock. But let me just say something about the Domestic Violence Act and the reasons why we called this gathering and this meeting today. Section 18, 3, 4, 5 and others of the Domestic Violence Act state that the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service must issue national instructions as contemplated in Section 25 of the South African Police Service Act 1995, with which its members must comply in the execution of their functions in terms of this Act, and any instructions so issued must be published in the Gazette. 4A of this section says, failure by a member of the South African Police Service to comply with any obligation imposed in terms of this Act or the national instructions referred to in subsection 3 constitute misconduct as contemplated in South African Police Service Act, and the Independent Complaints Directorate established in terms of that Act must forthwith be informed of any such failure reported to the South African Police Service. 4B of the Domestic Violence Act states that unless the Independent Complaints Directorate directs otherwise in any specific case, the South African Police Service must institute disciplinary proceedings against any member who allegedly failed to comply with an obligation referred to in paragraph A. 5A says the National Directorate of Public Prosecutions must submit any prosecution policy and policy directives determined or issued in terms of subsection 2 to Parliament, and the first policy and directive so determined or issued must be submitted to Parliament within 6 months of the commencement of this Act. 5B, the National Commissioner of South African Police Service must submit any national instructions issued in terms of subsection 3 to Parliament, and the first instruction so issued must be submitted to Parliament within 6 months of the commencement of this Act. The Independent Complaints, that is C, the Independent Complaints Directorate must every six months submit a report to Parliament regarding the number and particulars of matters reported to it in terms of subsection 4A and setting out the recommendations made in respect of such matters. 5D, the National Commissioner of the South African Police Service must. The National Commissioner of the South African Police Service must every 6 months submit a report to Parliament regarding 1, the number and particulars of complaints received against its members in respect of any failure contemplated in subsection 4A. 2, the disciplinary proceedings instituted as a result thereof and the decisions which emanated from such proceedings. And 3, steps taken as a result of recommendations made by the Independent Complaints Directorate. I'm reading the Act as is and would not want to add anything. The reason we are sitting here today is to check as to whether we indeed are complying with the Act and the complaints that we have been reporting every 6 months as stated by the Domestic Violence Act. We as the Portfolio Committee have indeed been visiting police stations. Can I mention that so far we have visited 4 provinces, that will be Mpumalanga Province, KwaZulu-Natal, Western Cape, as well as Gauteng recently. And can I mention that I only remember 1 police station where we really can say they are complying with this Domestic Violence Act, particularly when you check their domestic violence register, and that is Nelspruit Police Station. And probably because they decided to have a designated person who is responsible for the domestic violence register. Otherwise, in all other provinces, in all other police stations, even in the presence of ICD, we all have agreed that police are not recording or keeping information on domestic violence according to the Act. But we will probably want to hear today as to whether what we think is the situation on the ground is indeed recorded by those that are expected and reported to, or by those who are expected to report. We are going to take presentations, and really we'll request members to listen carefully. And then after presentations, then we are going to interact with the presentations. We'll be doing this so that we can save time. Otherwise, if we're going to take one presentation and engage on that, we might not finish on time. So the first presentation will be from ITED, and we've allocated time. You definitely must be... In fact, we've allocated time to you for both interaction and presentation. So you're going to present, and then we're going to take some questions. But if we are not done by 10 past 10, we then have to proceed to the next presentation. So you have up to 10 past 10 to make the presentation and interaction. And if you are not done by then, some of the questions that shall have not been responded to will then be responded to in writing. And that will be followed by SAPS and, of course, the organizations. Thank you.
Before we start, Chair, I'm hearing you referring to this entity as ITED. Am I wrong? I seem to remember we were told only December, January next year because they're still the ICD until, I don't know. Could someone just clarify what we refer to this unit as now? Thank you.
I think they are ITED, but they are presenting the work that they did as ICD, if I'm not mistaken. That is why this, because otherwise as ITED, they're no longer responsible for DVA, Domestic Violence Act. It will then become the responsibility of the Secretariat. But they are presenting the work that they were supposed to do and to present to us as ICD. ICD?
Thank you, Chairperson. We're still here as ICD. Without further ado, our presentation will be done by Mr. Moses Lamini, our Director IMS, and Ms. Bully, Program Manager 3, who's responsible for the DVA function within the department.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. We're going to be taking you through the types of non-compliance that we have to deal with in slide 2. That is the outline of the presentation. If I go to slide 3, I just want to mention the bullet point number 4, that the ICD must every 6 months submit a report to Parliament regarding the number and particulars of matters reported to it and set out the recommendations made in respect of such matters. And we have submitted the report that we're supposed to table in Parliament. The following 3 slides I'm going to skip because of time constraints and focus on a few slides from slide number 7. There, this is what the ICD does, or IPED does, in respect of dealing with its responsibilities in regard to domestic violence monitoring. We receive complaints from members of the public, and then we refer these complaints of non-compliance to the police for investigation or further disciplinary action against members, as the chairperson did read that section, which says failure to comply is misconduct. The police are then expected to apply for exemption from prosecution and set out the reasons why members did not comply with their obligations in terms of the Act and the national instructions. We also conducted audits at stations. The reports that we table contain details of such audits. We also conduct awareness campaigns to make the public aware of the responsibility or what they should expect from the police in terms of dealing with matters of domestic violence. We also conduct workshops with police and other stakeholders. If I go to slide number 8, that slide contains a consolidation of the kinds of matters that were reported to the ICD during the period January 2009 to December 2010. You would note that this amounted to 236 complaints, and most of them were reported in Gauteng, 27%, and Western Cape with 22%. Then the next slide, slide number 9, basically consolidate the complaints of non-compliance in terms of the type of matters that we receive. You would note that a lot of people, 30% out of that 236 complaints, people complained about police not arresting abusers of once an offense had been committed, even when people had warrants in 59 cases, they complained that the police did not execute those warrants or arrest the abusers. And if I go back again to slide number 11, you will see that in 10% of the complaints, the allegations were that police failed to open a docket and refer the matter to for prosecution. In a smaller number of cases, 2%, the allegations were that the police failed to seize to search and seize, and people had actually been threatened with firearms. Slide number 12. Talks about or breaks down this matter further. Police failing to issue a notice against an alleged transgressor to appear in court in 8% of the cases. So the total there for this entire period from January 2009 to December 2010, it's 236. Then the next slide, in slide number 13, gives you an indication of the number of applications of exemption that we received. Out of 236 complaints of non-compliance, we received 49 applications for exemption. Slide number 14 shows you that, well, you compare the numbers of cases received and the applications received. And we also show the difference that we should have received 187 applications for exemption. But as indicated in the preceding slide, we only received 49 out of the 236 cases. I will not dwell in through the following slide. I will go straight to slide number 17, which basically talks about how these matters were disposed of, how they were processed, and what the status is of all these matters. You would see that in Gauteng, out of the 17 cases during the period January to June 2009, out of 17 cases received, 7 were closed as unsubstantiated. It means that the allegations against the police were could not be substantiated. But however, 10 cases there are awaiting response. And in many of these, in the next 4 slides, you would see that a lot of the cases, the police never responded. What we invariably get is nil returns, saying there were no complaints of non-compliance against the police. So those nil returns are a bit problematic. If I go to slide number 18, if you look at Gauteng, you'll see that in 22 cases, July to December, 4 cases were closed, and 17 cases were still outstanding response. The ICD has raised this the concerns around the lack of response with the provincial commissioners. Our provincial heads interact also with the SAPS management at management forum, and they raise the matter of lack of response. It is a concern for us, Chairperson. Let me hand over to my colleague, Ms. Mbuli, to take you through the rest of the presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Lamin. Chairperson, member of the Portfolio Committee, good morning. I'm going to take you through in terms of the matters that we consider when doing a station audit. These are the areas that we normally check when we're doing the station audit.
Can you switch off your mic? Thank you.
These are the areas that we normally consider when we're doing station audits. I'm not going to mention all, but if you look at slide 21, we always check whether is there a copy of the DVA readily available in community service center. We also check whether it's a copy of national instruction readily available also in the community service center. We look at the domestic violence registers, which is SAPS 508B. We also check whether are there any reported DVA incidents recorded in the DVA register. SAPS forms 508A readily available. And then we also check whether are there copies of every protection order, which is on slide 22. Female members assigned on each shift. Is a victim-friendly care center readily available? We also check whether are there any non-compliant DVA records of members recorded on form SAPS 508. And in cases of non-compliance by members, were disciplinary proceedings instituted? If no steps have been taken against members, did they apply for exemption? Were recommendations or steps taken, exemption from disciplinary procedure recorded? And lastly, Chairperson, are monthly returns in relation to disciplinary action adhered to by commanders? Then the second slide, Chairperson, is on proactive oversight activities. The purpose of conducting these station audits is not to name and shame the police, but to encourage the stations to improve. Various ICD provincial offices conducted the audits at police stations to determine the level of compliance with the Domestic Violence Act and the National Instruction. ICD audited 280 stations during January to June 2009. Some stations were revisited, as you can see that Northern Cape audited 116 stations, Free State audited 52 stations, and also in July to December, it was 241 stations, January to June 2010, 177, and then July to December, 182. The target strategic objective for 2009-10 was 180 stations per annum, And then for 2010-11, it was 108 station audits per annum. And then, Chairperson, the following slide, it talks on overall level of compliance. As I indicated earlier on that we audited 280 police station audits during January to June 2009, and we found that 50 stations were complying on a level of non-compliance, which is 0 to 49%. 95 stations were complying on a level of fairly compliant, which is 50 to 79%. 104 stations were on a level of substantially compliant, which is 80 to 99%. And only 31 stations were fully compliant, that is 100%, with the DVA prescripts. And then for the period of July to December 2009, we conducted 241 police station audits. And out of that 241 police stations, 29 stations were complying on a level of non-compliant, 96 stations were complying on a level of fairly compliant, 96 stations were on a level of substantially compliant, which is 80 to 99%, and only 20 stations were fully compliant with the DVA prescripts. And then, Chairperson, if you look at the following slide, which is slide number 25, there we also did a station audit, but for January to June 2010. We conducted 177 police stations, and out of that 177 police stations, only 24 stations were complying on the level of non-compliant, 57 stations were complying on a level of fairly compliant, 84 stations were on a level of substantially compliant, and only 12 stations were fully compliant with the DVA prescript. And then for July to December 2010, we conducted 132 police station audits. 25 stations were complying on a level of non-compliant. 37 were complying on a level of fairly compliant. 56 stations were on a level of substantially compliant. And 14 stations were fully compliant with the DVA prescript. The following slide, it just gives you a short summary of the findings. As we indicated, that part of the audits included inspection of the SAPS 508A and B registers, ensuring the community service center had copies of DVA available, and a list of service providers was available in the event that a victim of domestic violence needed the service. And furthermore, inspection of the victim-friendly facility was conducted to ensure the facility was equipped to deal with the matters of domestic violence. And as you can see, Chairperson, that there was failure to apply for exemption, lack of understanding of the obligations of DVA, record keeping is still a concern. We've just listed the areas that we check where we felt that record keeping was a serious concern with SAPS. And then, Chairperson, this slide, slide 27, as you know, that one of our proactive oversight responsibilities is also to conduct community awareness. So when we do community awareness, we always do a public education in terms of the mandate of the ICD and also the role of SAPS when it comes to DVA. So we conducted 103 community awareness campaigns during January to June 2009 and 242 during July to December 2009. And we also did 120 community awareness activities during January to June 2010, and 170 July to December 2010. And then you find the details in terms of the areas that we visited and also the subjects that we covered in our DVA reports that we have tabled. And then slide 28 is workshops conducted. During 2009 and 2010, ICT organized and conducted workshops, but most of these workshops that we conducted were by invitation from various stakeholders, communities, NGOs, to discuss the implementation of the DVA in the national instruction. Other provinces, as you can notice, did not conduct any workshop. This is due to the fact that there were no invitations to conduct the workshops, or the opportunities did not present themselves. Then lastly, Chairperson, we still do have challenges when it comes to the DVA. The challenges that we normally have is that some SAPS management do not take disciplinary action against members. Yet the Act states that a failure by a member of the SAPS to comply with the obligations imposed in terms of DVA constitute misconduct. We also observe that some SAPS members do not apply for exemptions. Yet the SAPS are obliged to report to ICD all misconduct cases pertaining to non-compliance with the DVA. The ICD could, in turn, exempt members where a valid explanation for non-compliance is offered. And then thirdly, it's lack of understanding of the DVA by SAPS. Yes, we are aware that the SAPS does conduct training on their members on DVA. But we've observed that they seem not to focus on the administrative part of the DVA. Hence, they've got a challenge when it comes to record keeping and record management of the register. And we also noticed that it means that when they're doing their training, they also don't focus on areas that ICD audit when visiting the station. And then fourthly, the existence of a culture of silence around domestic violence. Although this is not honestly SAPS problem alone, but if you look at the number of complaints that we receive, and when one reads the newspapers and the reports that we normally receive from the NGOs about domestic violence, it is clear that there is still a culture of silence. And then lastly is the lengthy period taken to discipline SAPS members. The period of disciplining SAPS members, according to their standing orders, is 6 months. But we have observed at ICD that it takes longer than that for SAPS to discipline their members. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very, very much. We'll move to the next presentation. And that will be presentation by SAPS.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Maybe I should start by introducing the delegate from the South African Police Service, starting with myself, Lieutenant General Lebia, the Deputy National Commissioner responsible for crime detection. With me, I have got Lieutenant General Mutiba, the Divisional Commissioner for Visible Policing, Lieutenant Munu, the Divisional Commissioner for Detective Service, Major General Helden Hayes, Legal Services, Major General Pinard, Visible Policing, Major General Gwena, Human Resource Development, Brigadier Nchangase from the Family Violent Child Protection and Sexual Offences Unit, Brigadier Silimela from Visible Policing, Colonel Van Rooyen from Legal Service, and Lieutenant Colonel Steyn, Corporate Service. Madam Chair, the presentation is going to be done by managers in the following order. It will start with Major General Helden Hayes dealing with slide 1 up to 5, followed by Major General Gwena dealing with slide 6 to 13. Major General Pinar will deal with 10 and 11. Lieutenant General Moon will deal with 12 to 16, and then it will conclude with Lieutenant General Mutiba. After the presentation, the officers will be answering the questions relevant to their various environments. May I take this opportunity, Madam Chair, for the colleagues to take us through. Thanks.
Can I just mention that you have up to 10:45 to finish the whole presentation? That's all. Stop you.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, General. The slides 1 to 5, I will be dealing with that. The first slide was simply an introductory slide, but the second slide is simply a restatement of the provisions of the Domestic Violence Act. because we find that there are still quite a lot of uncertainty, not only amongst officials, but also amongst members of the public as to the exact responsibilities of the police service. So we have just enumerated that. The next slide deals with domestic violence cases. We say cases reported involving domestic violence. You see, Madam Chair, in our systems in the police service, we make provision that if somebody reports a crime, that a specific question is asked from the person entering this information in the computer. Is this domestic violence related? Because, Madam Chair, as you will know, domestic violence itself is not a crime. The crime is assault or theft or whatever. So what we are going to present to you here is the number of cases where that block was ticked. In other words, the person recording this information indicated that domestic violence was involved. Now, if we look at the numbers, they are per province, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but if you look at the totals, then for the first 6 months of 2010, it is 50,214. And for the second 6 months, it's 50,663. The total for the year, therefore, is a little bit more than 100,000 cases reported. Then the next slide deals with the complaints that we have received in respect of which we must report to Parliament. The total number of complaints that we received during the first half of 2010 was 13 and the second half 23. We found that in 5 cases during the first half, the complaint was found to be unfounded, in other words, unsubstantiated, so it's not possible to prove that the member did not comply with his obligations. In 2 cases in the first 6 months, and the same applied to the second 6 months, the person responsible for considering the complaint or the tribunal decided that the person must receive remedial counseling. In other words, to prevent him from repeating this. And then in 5 cases, a verbal warning was given. And in the second half, 3 cases, a written warning was given in the first half for 4 members, and in the second half for 6 members. During the first half, 1 member was actually dismissed as a result of non-compliance with his obligations in terms of the Domestic Violence Act. 3 cases, other sanctions were imposed, and this may include a fine or a suspended sentence or a suspended dismissal. And cases that are still under investigation during the first 6 months was 8. In other words, at the end of the first 6 months, we were still investigating 8 cases. And then during the second 6 months, 11 cases were still under investigation at the end of the 6 months. Now, in the first 6 months, a request for exemption was granted by the ICD in 5 instances, and in the second 6 months, in 14 instances. And during the first 6 months, at the end of the first 6 months, we had still 4 requests for exemption outstanding with the ICD. And the second 6 months, 8 cases outstanding. And then if we move on to the next slide, if we look at the complaints against members, this decreased by 36% during this period, if compared with the previous reporting period for 2009. This may be ascribed to training interventions that were increased. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'll continue with issues related to training. The purpose is to ensure compliance with the Act, regulations, and national instructions, and to develop the necessary skills to enable members to deal with incidents of domestic violence in a sensitive, professional, and efficient manner. It must be indicated that training on domestic violence is included in forms and forms an integral part of the basic training program for the new recruits since the year 2000. Till this far, a total number of 3,302 for the financial year 2009-2010 financial year, as well as the one that followed. New recruits underwent the basic training program, which includes domestic violence training. Insofar as in-service police development is concerned on members who are in the service for now, a five-day domestic violence learning program is being presented, and this includes sensitizing members to the social context and complex nature of domestic violence, practical skills in dealing with victims and victim support, and skills in executing obligations in terms of the Act and national instructions. For example, rendering of assistance to the victims and the completion of forms and registers. The courses that have been presented till this far for the financial year 2009-2010 in both areas as domestic violence, sexual offences and victim empowerment, the total is 5,649 members, and in the financial year 2010-2011, 4,118 members received courses in this regard. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In terms of the victim-friendly rooms at police stations, at the end of March 2011, we had in total 900 victim-friendly rooms at service points in the police. That includes 799 fully-fledged police stations, 20 satellite police stations, 22 at contact points, the three international airports have victim-friendly rooms, 27 at the offices of the FCS units that are not located at the police station, and then in our regular police stations we have 24, and 5 of them are mobile coaches, where the coaches that the police use are equipped with a facility for serving victims. Then the provision of victim-friendly rooms, in terms of providing rooms at all police stations, we set a target for 2014 to have all police stations equipped with such a victim-friendly facility. We are working together between Visible Policing and Supply Chain Management to provide 70 park home type victim facilities at stations in the current financial year. And all new police stations that are built, or all existing police stations that are provided with a new building, is then also provided with a victim-friendly facility that consists of one or more rooms, depending on the size of the police station.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Honourable Members. The establishment of the FCS unit. 176 FCS units have been established and are operational in all 9 provinces. There are 1,896 members attached to these units as at 31st March 2011. These exclude the forensic social workers. The forensic social workers' capacity will form part of the FCS staff and will be responsible for the forensic assessment of children, compilation of court reports, and testifying in court. Of the 1,896 members attached to the Family Violence, Child Protection, and Sexual Offences Unit, 1,538 have undergone training on the Act as at the end of July 2011. Outstanding members are nominated to attend the 5-week FCS Detective Learning Program course. Domestic violence is one of the modules in the domestic violence in the FCS course. Courses are scheduled for September and November 2011 and January 2012, where 50 members of FCS will be accommodated per course, which gives us a total of 250 members that will be trained in this financial year. In-service training is also provided to these members. Number of arrests and convictions, 1st January to 31st March, there were 12,048 arrests that were executed by members of the FCS. 529 convictions for crime perpetrated against child victims were recorded. 595 convictions for crimes perpetrated against adult victims were recorded. Initiatives undertaken by FCS units to ensure victim support. Under the auspices of the NPA, and FCS units are engaged in imbibers with community nationwide. FCS head office regularly attend meetings of the interdepartmental management team. This body develops, manages, and expands the Together Care Center model, guides governmental and civil society initiatives to address gender-based violence in SA, in South Africa, forms partnership with other countries in Africa to share lessons and best practices to enhance the development and implementation of regional gender justice structures. FCS units are committed to provide a professional service to all victims, inter alia, by ensuring investigations are conducted professionally and regular feedback is given. Data Office has identified the lack of child-friendly facilities at offices of the unit and has proactively sought sponsorship from donors to build or upgrade facilities. Sponsorships have already been secured for the building or upgrading of 6 facilities over the next 2 years, and more initiatives to obtain corporate sponsors are underway. In respect of each case reported to the SA Police involving domestic violence, a detective is designated to conduct a full investigation and present the docket to the public prosecutor. I will hand over now, Chair, to General Motiba.
Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, in respect of monitoring and evaluation, the Division Visible Policing conducts visits to stations, including visits for the purposes of assessing compliance with visible policing prescripts. The implementation of the Domestic Violence Act is included in the assessment template. During 2010-11 financial year, 58 full compliance visits were conducted. Shortcomings found during these visits are addressed within service training and corrective actions, and feedback is given to station, cluster, and provincial management. In respect of challenges, Chairperson, training will still be required to ensure that members deal with domestic violence incidents properly, and this is an ongoing thing. This is currently being addressed by basic training as well as in-service training. Gender sensitivity is required to properly deal with domestic violence incidents. This is currently being addressed by continuously presenting workshops on diversity and gender issues. Community not yet fully aware and sensitized about the protection afforded by the Act. Corporate communication has developed a communication strategy which focuses inter alia on the raising of awareness of the protection afforded to victims of domestic violence. This includes posters, printed material and promotional items, radio talks, imbizos, and so forth. Proper coordination between different state departments, non-governmental organizations and community initiatives is essential, Chairperson, to properly deal with domestic violence incidents. Victims also sometimes electing to withdraw charges for various reasons such as economic dependency and others. Insufficient resources for immediate provision of victim-friendly facilities at all service points, as victim-friendly facilities are not yet available in all the stations. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, this concludes the presentation by the South African Police Service.
Thank you very, very much for that. We will go to the civil society organization to make their presentation. But you know, one of the questions that really I would want SAP to respond to, just from your presentation, is to say you are few blocks away from Pretoria Central Police Station, and you're saying you visit these police stations and intervene. Did you ever visit just that police station, which you can actually walk from your offices to the police station? Did you ever visit that? This can probably be seen to be anything close to anything we might want to hear. But the largest police station, one of the largest police stations in the country, will be Johannesburg Central Police Station. Have you ever visited that police station? Just to check, these things that you say you are doing here, I'm just asking you to probably think of responding to this question. Thank you. Let's go to the civil society.
Good morning, Chairperson, Honourable Members. My name is Dimelo Kosimili. I represent the Community Law Center Parliamentary Program. We have Professor Lillian Arts from UCT who will be presenting research. We also have Ms. Lita Vetten, the Director for the Tswaranang Legal Advocacy Center. We also have Mr. Nageli from the Limpopo Legal Advice Center. We would like to please begin with Ms. Lisa Vetten's presentation. So I hand over to Ms. Vetten. Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee. What I am wanting to do is present you copies, in particular a short summary of the report that's been handed out to you entitled The Right and the Real. What this is intended to be is a kind of shadow annual report of the police's annual report to Parliament, focusing specifically on the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act and the Sexual Offences Act. I've obviously not emphasised the Sexual Offences Act that much, given that your focus is the Domestic Violence Act today. And I think, in terms of the information that we're going to present, it came from all official documents that are in the public domain, which the police have put out. We also drew on parliamentary minutes, as well as the medium-term strategic framework for the police and their annual plans. We've also looked at the police's budget votes, in terms of trying to arrive at this information, getting a sense of what budget is being allocated. And where we could not obtain information from those official public sources, we also made access to information applications to the police, and in this way got information about their training, in particular of the FCS units. And we then just had a brief overview of the findings in terms of to what extent will the police comply with their legislative mandate, what is the budget that they allocate in order to be able to implement, what is the training they engage in, and then finally, because this legislation ultimately intended to promote women's access to justice, how do we measure that? Are they indeed receiving justice? So just to give you a sense of the police's commitment, I think it's quite clear and has been since 1996 to the National Crime Prevention Strategy that the police have consistently prioritized violence against women. One sees it in the presidency's most recent medium-term strategic framework, as well as in the JCPS priorities, their performance plans, strategic plans, and budget votes. So it's said to be a priority on paper. How does it translate into practice? So I think if we just begin with the... I'll just go straight to... You've seen the data from the ICD that looks at the police's compliance with the Act in terms of the administrative mandate. And as you can see, the data they presented today merely continues an ongoing pattern that you've seen from 2006, where compliance is the exception rather than the rule. And I think why one wants to highlight this is that this is a legislative mandate. What is required by law? It's not an aspiration or a nice to have. It is a minimum. So it is a concern that routinely the majority of stations would not appear to be able to meet that 100% compliance rate. Why this also becomes of significance is that in terms of the Firearms Control Act, when somebody makes an application for a competency certificate to be permitted a license for a firearm, the designated firearm officer is required to check whether or not that person has a protection order against them. They will check this through the domestic violence registers. If the domestic violence registers are not being maintained, the designated firearms officer will not be able to check whether or not that person has a protection order against them, whether or not they should be given a firearm. So I think it is not nitpicking to be concerned about the failure to keep domestic violence registers or all the other formwork, all the other forms required by the Act. There are very real and dangerous consequences in not having that information readily available. The other problem, of course, is that if the police are not keeping warrants of arrest, where women's partners tear up their protection orders and their warrants, if they go to the station and there isn't one there, then they sit with a problem. So I want to again re-emphasize that it is not nitpicking to be concerned that the police do not maintain their paperwork in the way that they should. I want to look now also at an analysis of the ICD reports. We've looked at the complaints made to them between the period 2001 to 2008. And in total, you can see that 1,121 complaints were made in that period. The ICD, on conclusion of the investigations, recommended disciplinary action in about 83% of those complaints. But from what one can see from the official police response is that only 5% of matters actually resulted in disciplinary proceedings having been instituted. In more than two-thirds of the cases, there either appears to be no response whatsoever or very little response to the ICD. And I think this is a great concern because it does suggest that oversight is not functioning in the way it should. Now, there's a reference in parliamentary minutes in 2007 that the police's ability to disregard the ICD's recommendation was strengthened by the removal of a regulation that obliged the station commissioner to provide reasons for rejecting ICD recommendations. I think the other concern, and I acknowledge that possibly the police have tabled these reports, but they've not been discussed by the committee, but in terms of the Act, I think in terms of the Act, as the Chair outlined at the outset, the police should be submitting reports to Parliament every 6 months. So if we take into account the fact that the Act came into effect at the end of 1999, so the first report should have been submitted in 2000, that means that roughly there should have been 20 reports presented to you. One can at this point find only three. Now, as I said, that may well be the police have tabled them, but they've not been discussed by the committee. But the three we were able to find that had been discussed by the committee were two in 2007 and one in 2008. And I think just as an observation, they really don't provide in any way the level of detail that you see within the ICD reports. It's either a PowerPoint presentation or about 1.5 pages, most of which is taken up with stating what the obligations are. So I think as a recommendation to the committee, one would like to suggest that very clear guidelines be given to the police around what should be contained in those reports. I think much more information needs to be put forward. I think if we talk about training, it has been repeatedly, I think, brought to attention that there is a problem around the police's training in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, and I think they've just reiterated that again now. But I think the Auditor General's report in 2009 highlighted training as not having been adequate. Both the police, the ICD, and Parliament in other discussions have also said the training is inadequate. The figures put forward in the annual report are in 2008-09, 2,626 officers trained, and in the following year, 2,181. I think if you look at the total number of police, which is now sitting probably over 190,199, it's clear that I think not enough members are being trained. One accepts that not every police officer is going to need to be trained because some are going to be administrative personnel, but that number out of the total service is pretty low. And then I think if we turn to the budget, one finds no reference at all in the police budget votes to the Domestic Violence Act. One saw a little bit of reference right in the beginning to putting aside money for implementation, but I think such references have now completely disappeared, which is a concern when one sees the training figures. If we look at access to justice, the JCPS have said to the police that they are required to reduce contact crimes like rape and domestic violence by 4-7% annually. I think the concern with this is that while it's well-intentioned, I think every single one of us would like to see crimes like rape and domestic violence go down. I think that's absolutely the right intention. I don't think it's actually for the police to be able to achieve this, and I think setting them those targets confuses reporting to the police with a charge being laid and the incidence of a crime with the actual crime being reported. And I'm just going to give you the police's own statistics which will show you these discrepancies. In that 6 month period between January to June 2007 from the report they gave to Parliament then, they said some 45,000 domestic violence incidents were reported, but it appears that only 17,000 actually became a criminal charge. Another example from the research that we did in Acorn Hook, where we collected 942 complaints from the hospital, the courts, and the police station. But only 63 of those cases actually resulted in charges. So I think for us to expect the police to be reducing domestic violence, and so much of it is not actually being reported to them, is possibly the wrong policy choice, that in this instance we would actually like to see more domestic violence being reported to the police rather than less, because we can see quite clearly that much of it is not actually being made, transformed into charges. And I think the same applies to rape. In 2002, drawing on the South African Demographic and Health Survey by the Department of Health, women who responded, only 1 in 9 of those who said they had been raped said they had reported to the police. And then data last year, in Gauteng only, which surveyed about 900 women, found that only 1 in 25 who said they'd been raped had reported the matter to the police. So I think when you have such extensive underreporting, it's very clear that to want to drive the number of reports down further is not actually the correct policy response. What you really want to be doing is to be seeing more women coming forward and reporting. And I think as a consequence, what I want to put these statistics forward, these are the rape statistics, well, they're now sexual offence statistics. I think it's important to bear in mind that these are figures for all 59 sexual offences that have now been created in terms of the old Sexual Offences Act and the new Sexual Offences Act. And I think from these figures, there are about 7 police stations here with truly startling increases and decreases. And I think these need to be looked at very carefully, because I think we again need to be asking what is going on with the reporting of rape, and are there perverse incentives being introduced into the system? Because if you set a performance target for people that they cannot realistically meet, then I think they will find other ways of trying to meet that performance. So I'd like to just draw your attention to Mount Road in the Eastern Cape, which in 2009-2010 managed to achieve a 1,000% reduction in the number of sexual offences reported at that station, which I think needs to be queried further. Johannesburg Central, which you've already alluded to, is another station that requires investigation. In 1 year, the number of reported sexual offences increased by 379% and then dropped by 452% the following year. So I think when the police report that they're reducing the number of sexual offences committed in the country, you can actually see last year that just the reductions in those 7 stations alone would have produced the decrease in reported figures that the police spoke of. And I think we've already seen, the ICD has already investigated and found that in some stations cases are being dumped, possibly to reduce statistics. And you will find extracts from some research we did in the report where we also have detectives explaining the pressure being placed on them not to record and put onto the CAS system rape cases in order to keep their figures down. What they're explaining is that they're being told to look at what were the figures for March last year, what are the figures for March this year. If the most recent figures are starting to exceed last year's, then you need to stop recording cases. So I think the clear way to deal with this is possibly to reconsider that target for the piece of reducing rape. Given the extensive rate of underreporting, one actually thinks they should be looking at increases so that we can see that more women and children are coming into the system. I want to talk a little bit about the FCS units. As you've already heard, they were supposed to have come fully into effect on the 1st of April. I think what one wants to just highlight as a matter of concern is that in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, the police are required to have tabled their training program in Parliament within the first 6 months of the Act's promulgation, and the Act was promulgated in December 2007. The police did not table their training program. While they have been training, they've also not tabled their training reports around the Sexual Offences Act. And once again, in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, such training reports need to be submitted to Parliament on an annual basis. So I think that is something that the committee would also want to follow up. In terms of the information that we obtained via the PIRA application, it would appear that since the Act was introduced at the end of 2007, some 2,491 CSC officers have been trained. Again, one wants to highlight the low number as a matter of concern. The CSC officers are victims' first point of contact. If victims cannot get beyond the CSC, they will never get to the specialised FCS detectives. And I think if victims are badly treated in the CSC, it's unlikely that they're going to want to continue. So one would really want to see an increase in this number of CSC officers being trained. And then they provided a number of 2,557 FCS and general detectives trained. So to suggest that probably about 1,000 more general detectives have been trained if I look at the figures provided by the police. As you can see, we had figures for 2009-10, which said 806 victim support rooms. So it's good to see the number has increased. I think our concern is that, and we make this observation in terms of Gauteng, is that often what is happening in practice is that the keys to those support rooms is being given to particular individuals. If those individuals are not on duty, then those rooms remain locked. So a victim arrives at the station but cannot use the room because it is locked. And it has been locked to apparently prevent police officers from sleeping and watching TV and eating in those rooms. So I think there is a broader problem around the management of those victim support rooms. We have been doing training with the victim empowerment centres and community policing forums. One of the issues that they have highlighted is that many of those who work in the victim support rooms have not received any training. They've literally been given a book and said, please read this, and that's been their training. So I think there is a bit of a concern around the quality of care that is being provided at station-level victim support rooms. I think it's too early to say how the FCS units are doing, but I think from some of the work we've been doing, again, in Gauteng, there are early indications that there are challenges. I must acknowledge that these are anecdotal. We haven't done a full provincial survey, but there's enough there to, I think, warrant a little bit of concern. And one of these is in the areas of human resourcing. What FCS detectives have told us when we've gone and done station visits and training is that they are not fully capacitated in terms of the number of detectives that they require. So as a consequence, they are prioritizing children's cases over adults' cases. And there is a bit of a perception that adults are somehow tougher and so can cope better with being raped than a child, so therefore don't necessarily require as much specialized treatment, which I would want to disagree with. And I think you can see this prioritization seeming to translate itself into who's getting specialized care at the Tutuzela care centers. Why I'm highlighting this is that if you look at the police statistics, about 10,000 more adult women report rape every year than children, so you would expect, therefore, that more adults are going to show up at specialized services. But if you look at the Tutuzela care center records, 60% of those they saw between 2003-2006 were children, and in 2010, this is very similar, this is again 58%. So where are we losing the adult women? Again, if one asks what is happening, we have been given a couple of explanations. The first is that if the general detectives see the woman, they just take them to any service. Sometimes they also just drop them off at the hospital. They don't actually go in with them and wait. And so the woman gets up and leaves because they don't feel like they've just been left alone in a foreign and alien environment. So I think we have to look at what is going on. Why are we using adult women? What is the quality of care that they are receiving? What is also important is the need for resources to be allocated to the FCS units. The police themselves have noted it, but we don't see them noting that translating into budget or discussions of budget in the actual budget votes. And I think this question of budget has been highlighted by two different studies that have looked at FCS units and resourcing. And two of the issues they highlighted were the sexual assault evidence kits, for example, that where station had not adequately budgeted for those kits, stations were running out of them. FCS detectives were sometimes driving into up to 100 kilometres at a time, going to different stations to try and collect kits. We also had reports from one place in Mpumalanga and a couple of places in Gauteng that what sometimes was happening was that they were even throwing out the evidence and reusing those sexual assault kits. So I think the question of a budget for the kits is extremely important. And I think the other area where budget also becomes highly important is transporting victims. In many instances, especially in the case of children, the police provide the only link that children get to services because they are the ones who pick up children, take them to the social work and get them to be seen. If they don't have budgets for transport to be able to do that, those children don't get services. Victims don't get to court. So I think this question of the budget and who manages it is incredibly important. It should remain under the management of those units, not the police stations for general detectives, as it would appear that they do tend to use those budgets for other things. And then I think the other concern is experience. Many highly experienced FCS detectives of 13 and 15 years were lost in the redeployments of 2006. And so many new detectives have come in. At one cluster we visited, the majority of the detectives they had just completed college. So again, that points to a very important question about the level of mentoring and support that is given to those new detectives. There are also questions of knowledge. Again, when we have been doing visits to police stations and we've asked FCS units for the forms that allow for compulsory testing religiosity for HIV, we have been told that they don't have them, or we've been told that it's not a police responsibility, it's the health responsibility, and we must go and talk to health about that, which actually, if you go and read the police's national instructions, is incorrect. So I think there is definitely a need to build experience and knowledge amongst FCS units, while they are potentially going to be a really important weapon in addressing crimes against women and children. Training, experience, knowledge, and budgets are going to be crucial to make them live up to their promise. I think also just to conclude, as a key recommendation, the FCS units are comprised of detectives, so they're chiefly concerned with investigation. They're not the solution to domestic violence. In terms of domestic violence, their mandate is restricted to attempted murder and assault GBH, and they will only investigate breaches of the protection order if it's part of an assault GBH or an attempted murder case already being handled. So what you can see is that, I think understandably, to keep the FCS mandate manageable, they're not going to be dealing with every domestic violence case. And as you may have seen from the statistics I gave earlier, the vast majority of domestic violence cases do not translate into criminal charges. So they're going to be dealt with by members of the CSC. And as you can see from the audits, that's where the problem lies. So I think when it comes to the policing of domestic violence, the FCS units by themselves are not a comprehensive response. The police must look at what are they doing with the CSCs and look at other ways of developing a much more comprehensive response to domestic violence. I think in terms of the money bills, we would like you as a committee to inquire into the extent of the SAPS's budgeting towards the Domestic Violence and Sexual Offences Act, that you also ask that the police start reporting as a matter of course on the extent and use of donor funding to augment their activities. They report in their annual report, for example, that they received $1.2 million from the U.S. Embassy in order to develop and conduct the training around the Sexual Offences Act. That's a concern because it tells us either that they did not themselves budget to do that training, and also raises the question that if they had not received that donor funding, would the training have happened? So we would like you to be looking at these questions. I think also to play a role, obviously, in looking at the police's budgets, their priorities, their objectives, their plans and annual reports, and that when they put together their performance indicators, that their legislative commitments in terms of the Domestic Violence Act and the Sexual Offences Act actually become part of those performance indicators. I would really also recommend that you engage very critically with the interpretations the police offer of their statistics. I think as the ones I showed you, once you start looking what's going on at station level, a lot of questions need to be asked. I would also like to recommend that the SAPS tables a 5-year comprehensive training plan to you on both the Domestic Violence Act and the Sexual Offences Act, and that they should also set targets for what the numbers of officers that they're going to be training every year, and I think really, really importantly, how are they going to assess those officers? Because it's very easy to sleep your way through a 3-hour PowerPoint presentation and say you've been on Domestic Violence Act training. But we would actually recommend that competency testing be conducted after every training, and that those officers who are found not to be competent do not work in FCS units, do not deal with domestic violence victims. So I think invite diversity of NGOs, as you've done today, and we thank you for that, to participate. We would also like to draw your attention, if you're not already aware of it, of the hearings on the Domestic Violence Act tabled last year by the Women, Children and People's Disabilities Portfolio Committee. They instituted a number of recommendations in relation to the police, and I think one would like the committee to be able to follow up on those recommendations. And I think finally our concern is that it is crucially important that this committee monitor the regulations that the Civilian Secretariat for Police develops in relation to the domestic violence. There is a very real risk that with the transfer of oversight from the ICD to the CSP, that the limited oversight that we are already seeing in relation to the Domestic Violence Act is going to be diluted even further. So we would really ask the committee to pay close attention to the development of those regulations, because they do potentially offer the scope to strengthen oversight by doing things like, at this point in time, the ICD may monitor and audit police stations, but there is no obligation on the police to do anything about the findings of those audits. There are no time frames in which they need to get things right. There are no consequences for not getting things right. And I think the regulations may be a way in which you could deal with this, and this is why I really do want to encourage you as the committee to be paying close attention to that. I think also this will mean questions for what is the budget for the Civilian Secretariat? Will they have the resource and the capacity to continue auditing and to follow up? And what powers do they have? What are they going to do if the police are not complying? Because I do want to just conclude with this quote from the Constitutional Court in a sexual offences matter that dealt with intermediaries, Pasani, where the court said that compliance with the Constitution requires not only that laws be enacted to give effect to the rights in the Constitution, but also requires that those laws be implemented. Failure to implement laws that protect constitutional rights is a violation of the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa Vetten. We would like to now call upon Mr. Nakedi from the Limpopo Legal Advice Office to please address the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and the rest of the Parliamentary Committee on Police, and our colleagues from the civil society. Good morning.
Can I just interrupt you, sir? I'm sorry. The organization have up to 11:30 to finish its presentation. So I'm just cautioning you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. First of all, I think we would like to thank you for this opportunity. We would like to simply bring the following to you before I get into the statement I have written down, to share the experience with you and to bring this very important thing that I think the police, the ICD, and the rest should regard it as very important. Limpopo is in a majority of rural. And as a result of that, there is a problem of disseminating information. There is a problem of accessing this kind of information that is needed. There are three structures: the rural community, the traditional structures, and those police stations that are operating deeply in the rural areas. What I need to bring before I get into it is to the relationship and how we can work together, the ICD, the police, together with NGOs, to make sure that information is getting to the rural community, is getting to the traditional structures, to the police structures that are operating there, regarding the domestic violence and the rest of the act. There is a lack of coordination on that. The problem of domestic violence is really a problem to, particularly in the rural areas. Many of them need more information. Many of them still need education. Many of you that being a victim of sexual assault, domestic violence, and child abuse does not bear any honor. As a matter of fact, these offenses are the most demeaning, destructive, and heinous crimes that could have happened to a human being. I think it's a smart, you might call it a smart statement, but the fact of the matter, as I said, there is a problem between the rural community, the traditional chiefs, and the NGOs that are there. It seems to me that the police, on their intention, I don't know, the ICD and other structures are undermining the NGOs who are rooted next to the community, to make sure that really this problem of domestic violence are solved. Normally I've been a victim of this situation. Everybody can feel very bad. I'm not going to follow all the statements. I'm going to just highlight. For example, there is a survey that was conducted by United Nations in Johannesburg. A quarter of all boys interviewed said that Jack Rowling is a term of gang rape and was fun. And more than half of the interviewees insisted that when a girl says no to sex, she really means yes. These are the issues that are not known to the police. They are known to us as NGOs. We are there, we understand these things, but then it is the responsibility of the police and other stakeholders like ICD to come to us to identify if a young person is really have this type of belief that Jack Rowling is in terms of the game like this is just fun. Can you see that it is a problem? The most important thing is to make sure that we come together. We are experiencing these things and we need the police to act. We have witnessed as a community based active, we have witnessed in rural areas of Limpopo growing issues of sexual violence, domestic violence and child abuse, and thousands of cases that go unsolved and prosecuted, particularly in the deep rural areas of Limpopo. I think that was this really was supported by the presentation from the police. You can see in their presentations the small amount of convictions that are there. And really these are the things that really you cannot just sit down at home while there is this kind of situation. You cannot pretend that it doesn't happen, makes no difference to the pernicious effect it has on the bodies and minds of many women. And it is eating to the soul of our society. It is killing our children. And it is killing all of us. So no one can sit down and say nothing is happening. Chair and the rest of the participants here today, I want to emphasize the point on communication, on the police coming together with the community. The NGOs are there. There are community projects that we are connected with. What is very, very important is that in Limpopo, we have discovered that the rural police stations, many of them, and of which I will kindly request the chair and the rest of the parliamentary committee to come and identify those police stations. When a domestic violent is reported to them, they are referring that to the traditional chief. And the traditional chief, the resolution there is that he even end up saying they must both of them pay a certain fee according to the traditional court there. And you must remember that the police station said, no, this is not, in terms of the culture of this area, you mustn't report it, go back to the police station first. Those are the witnesses. We have got the records from our Limpopo Legal Advice Center to indicate and show some of the victims that really confronted us after they went to the police and after they went to the traditional authority where they were victimized and humiliated in front of what we call traditional horror and so on and so on. Said, no, you are wrong, you have to do this. All of these things really prompted us to come here to you, Chair, and all members of the Parliamentary Committee to really start very serious that it seems to us that there is a problem of police stations that are operating in the urban areas and police stations that are operating in the rural areas. Those
members of the police stations, we approached many of them having on hand the victim. Why are you not opening this case? Let alone the insult we got. We are used to that. Why are you not opening this? You find that the police man who was supposed to open a case does not even know what the sexual, the domestic violence is. He does not even know. And I cannot be able to blame him and say, or insult him. What is happening is we just record all these things. That is why the conviction, the arrest and the conviction, the conviction is very low. And I'm very much concerned, particularly in the rural areas. I have seen that the church did not visit Limpopo. But I think in future when you visit at Limpopo Legal Advice Center, we are not going to, the police must not now say we are giving you information that we have got information, but it is there. We will be able to point out the police stations, not individuals, the police station that is having problems in the rural. And I want to ask whether there are policemen who are assigned to the urban and those who are assigned to the rural. Because those who are assigned to the urban, they seem to understand that there is an act that is out, the law is out, and we have to do this. And I've got a problem on the issues. Of course, I'm going to respond to the questions where they say that there are training and so on and so on. My prayer is that all mankind becomes more involved for all mankind. There is no room for selfishness when it comes to protecting one's way of living or the freedom to be free as a human race. We need to remove all the borders and tunnel visions if we want the world, our world to survive. It is hard to fight our invisible monster and so on and so on. I don't want just smart statement, but the fact of the matter is there is a problem. The forensic expert, the police, the prosecution have to treat the survivor's body as a crime scene. But it seems to me in the rural areas, take those police stations and those police guys who are claiming to service that particular rural community, you'll be shocked. You'll be shocked. I'm not condemning them, but I think at the end we've got to suggest something. But often they end up making things worse than necessary for the survivor. That's what I'm saying. You report to them, they take that woman, go to Horo, and Hoshi makes also worse. He let this lady pay, but she's raped and was turned back by the police. Making things worse than necessary for the woman's evidence is the prosecution's main weapon in the trial. What we have discovered here in our experience in the rural areas is that it seems to us that the police does not know what they are doing. If a person comes to report all these offenses of domestic violence, sexual offense, child abuse, and so on and so on, it seems to me if a person is abused, he finds in the reception a senior abuser, an abuser of this child and women abuse or domestic violence who does not have that information. Are you saying that person can be able to handle that case? Of course not. What he's going to do is to cover this thing under the carpet. Many of them, we've got some of the names that are still beating their wives as police. And we call them senior abusers, but we are not accusing them. Maybe they were not aware that there is law that is really preventing them. That is why those senior police have continued refusing this victim to open. They continue sweeping the information under the carpet. South Africa is a criminal justice system from the police, courts, prisoners is flawed and stressed, but if perpetrators were effectively prosecuted and jailed, this would act as both deterrent and punishment. Then the alternative is vigilantism and mob justice, which as civil society organizations here today
do not approve of that. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in the rule of law. What is very important is we are appealing to the chair and all the members of the Portfolio Committee on Police and the representatives of the police here to start including ICD, to start including the NGOs. Do not undermine them. Carry us. We have got more information that will assist you. We have heard ICD saying they have run the workshops. I don't know where these people are running workshops. I don't know where they're running workshops. Maybe in Petersburg, in the legislature there. There are problems in the rural areas where they can be able to go there, come to us, run the workshop there, where people should listen. But I don't know where they're running these workshops. I don't know where this training is going on. And after the training, these people, how they disseminate this to the community, I don't know. Well, maybe through the SABC radio, Tovela. Are you saying when you go there, talk to through the radio, are you giving these people information? No. There is still a challenge that needs to be done. What is very important is the we need to work with the police. We need to assist them to make sure that we identify people who are doing all these heinous crimes. But they are not there. They are not approaching us. If either they are scared to come to us, Limpopo Legal Advice Center, fearing that as they are the most abusive, we will expose them. Or something else that we don't know. Something else that we don't know, Che. But the fact of the matter is, there is something that needs to happen. We are opening our civil society. We need to work with ICD. We are there. Identify us. We will assist you. Don't go to the media and say, appeal to the community to give you a criminal. Come to us. Come to us on the ground and tell us what is happening. Don't go there. It doesn't mean that you mustn't go, but what is very important, there are small things that is happening in the community. Limpopo Legal Advice Centers is connected to many projects in the province. Any problem that is happening there, within an hour, we can be able to, they can communicate with us. We can identify 1, 2, 3 problems. Lastly, of course, there must be a campaign. Education to the rural community, education specifically to the traditional authorities. I do not want to insult our chief. I'm a tribalist myself. What is very important is to make sure that we educate those people around the problem of domestic violence, sexual offense, child and women abuse. And lastly, at the root of this complex judicial problem is something quite simple: staffing, training, and logistics. So thank you very much, Chair.
Good morning, everyone. I think it's still morning. I'm Lillian Arts. I'm from the Gender Health and Justice Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. And I just want to thank the committee for the opportunity of presenting. I will try to stick to the last 12 minutes that I have to do the presentation, so I will fly through it as quickly as I can. I think there's always a concern when you have civil society organizations at these meetings that they're here purely to take a critical look, a critical edge to policing and policing services. And I just want to start by saying that we've had a very historically good relationship with the police, who have taken on a lot of our concerns and recommendations over the years. So I just want to say that they have been receptive to some of our recommendations. We've also seen that the monitoring and sort of internal documentation processes of the police have improved exponentially since we started monitoring the Domestic Violence Act in 1999. So there have been, you know, some successes in terms of how you're gauging your own performance in terms of the Act. We've also seen very constructive research coming out of the ICD as well, which has been quite foundational in terms of how we're monitoring its implementation. With that said, there are some critical concerns about the implementation of the Act. And what I'm going to do is to refer to the findings of three studies we've conducted over the last few years. And I want to warn you that it's an absolute snapshot of the data. It's not meant to be comprehensive. And you really have a lot of the findings sitting in front of you. So when you have the time, you can sink your teeth into those. So, but we're just going to give you the big stuff that we think are quite big fault lines in terms of the implementation of the Act. So the research the findings that we're going to discuss today are based on three studies. The one we've just finished this year, where we interviewed 503 DDA applicants with an organization that we work with. Another is from 2008, which is an additional 365 applicants who are going through the process. And the third is actually a project we did with SAPS a few years ago, where we conducted station audits, we looked at dockets, interviews, and it was a really constructive process. But what we haven't seen are our recommendations moving forward, which I find quite concerning, because it was quite a detailed study which gave very pragmatic low resource solutions to some of the implementation processes that we had witnessed. So I just want to present some of those findings. So one of the things that has occurred to me is that we really don't have a sense of who DBA complainants are coming to the police stations. We have certain assumptions about who they are. And when I interview police, they're frustrated about particularly women coming into the station, asking for protection orders and not returning on the return dates or withdrawing charges. And I think we've been talking a lot about training today, and I think part of what the issues are is that we're not really getting into the social context of the types of clients that SAPS are servicing. What we do know is that they've known their partners for many, many years. They've experienced this abuse for at least 4 years before they've come to the police to secure legal intervention of sorts. Children are highly affected by domestic violence, both directly and indirectly. And many of these women in particular, and we've got complainants that are both male and female, but they're largely women, and they've been experiencing violence for a very, very long time. I think once you've tried to, go to social welfare or family counseling or exhausted community structures, sometimes the police are the first and also the last entry point into a system. And I think we need to be cognizant of the fact that you are working with a clientele, so to speak, that has exhausted many of their options before they approach the police. I don't think these findings are particularly surprising. What I do want to highlight, though, is that we are seeing an increased amount of domestic violence happening during pregnancy, and we are now starting to document high levels of sexual violence within domestic relationships. And I think if we're going to talk about training and resource allocation, we need to start thinking about the nexus between the Domestic Violence Act and the Sexual Offenses Act. These are not two separate entities. They're not two separate domains. They happen within the same familial context. And we need to get our heads around how we're going to manage that nexus between children's issues, the Children's Act, the Sexual Offenses Act, and the Domestic Violence Act. You've seen this a million times before. There are a few essential duties that the police must perform. They're positive legal duties. I don't think they're a stretch in terms of assistance, but unfortunately our findings are showing that even the basics aren't being attended to at station level. I know very recent work, we found some very positive findings. We asked domestic violence complainants and applicants whether they had gone to the police after a domestic violence incident, and they said yes. So we're getting high levels of reporting. Did you go after the last incident? Yes, I did. Were you told to get a protection order? Yes, I was. The police told me to get a protection order. Did they accompany you to collect your belongings? 68% said yes. So there is some service happening at the entry point. This is where things get slightly worrying for me. Were you told that you could lay a criminal charge? And 69% were not told they could also lay a criminal charge in addition to securing a protection order from the magistrate's courts. Of those who were told that they could lay a criminal charge, 53% were told they weren't allowed to, that they must simply proceed to the magistrate's courts. This is totally unacceptable. It's a basic construction. It's a basic right to be able to lay a charge. It's a basic, you know, procedure within policing to open the docket. I don't understand why this isn't happening. Did you receive a notice with information on your rights? 96% were not given the notice. It's a sheet of paper. It's called Form 1. They should be at all police stations. And as a matter of course, they should be issued. They're simply not being issued. It gives complainants basic information, including the right to lay criminal charges. Were you taken for medical assistance? 67% were not taken when needed or requested. Okay. We've also done quite a lot of docket analysis where we've looked at the nature of charges, the nature of domestic relationships, whether complainants are adults or children. We've looked at Section 17 dockets, which are breaches of the protection order, other offenses, and arrest rates. I'm just going to give you a brief sample of some of these findings. I have to tell you that this is one of the studies that we did with the police, and they were very receptive to the findings. I think we just need to take that next step of figuring out sort of procedurally how we proceed in terms of documentation and referrals. So docket types, you'll see that we have quite serious cases of domestic violence, assault, GBH being the dominant type of offenses, but we also have a lot of breaches of the protection order. 18% of dockets are breaches of the protection order. We also have high levels of rape, as you can see there, and 15% assault comments. So at least half of these are quite grievous physical acts of violence that we're attending to. A copy of the protection order was present in 75% of the dockets, which I think is a very positive finding. Arrests were made in approximately 80% of the cases. I think it's also a very positive finding. And additional charges were laid in 30% of those breach dockets. They could be rape, assault, GBH. So I think once we have a breach of the protection order, I think something is happening in terms of the correct charges being laid with those cases. However, in section where there were non-Section 17 cases, assault, GBH, so on and so forth, the protection order was only present in 2.4% of the dockets. That's just unacceptable. There should at least be a copy of the domestic violence incident form or a protection order contained within that docket, and they're simply not there. Part of the DV register the DV incident form allows for the police member to take a history of the abuse. That becomes critical later on. It reflects that it's not a once-off incident. There is a history of violence. The form asks questions about, were you hospitalized, were you assisted with hospitalization, have there been interventions? It's a record. It's a record of that cycle of violence, and I think it's one of the most powerful things we can use in court. We found that an arrest was made in 52% of the non-Section 17 cases, which I think is also a reasonable arrest rate, although it could be higher, and I think one of the things we should start exploring is the reasons for the low arrest rates. And there might be perfectly reasonable reasons why only half of the cases are being arrested. We just don't have the empirical evidence to demonstrate what those reasons are. Details that were contained in the dockets, it was worrying to me that only 16% of the dockets had any information about the history of the abuse. Has this happened before? Has a criminal charge been laid? Have you gone to the police? Have you been hospitalized? Absolutely no information. It's promising that 96% gave some level of detail about the incidents of violence. 80% gave information about the nature of the injuries, which is great. Only 10% spoke to previous reports. 5% had information about previous charges laid. Use of a weapon, only 50% of the dockets had information about use of a weapon in the 100% of cases where there was a weapon. So these are other sort of indicators that we can use in police training. You know, what are the essential elements that you need to contain in the docket? And in my opinion, sometimes it's just a 10-point checklist of have you asked the following? I think we can develop full compliance through very, very simple measures, such as statement-taking protocols. In 73% of cases, the complainant was injured. However, in only sort of less than half the amount of J88 was obtained for injuries. I think that's just it's another positive legal duty on police to ensure that complainants receive medical attention, and it wasn't happening in half the cases that we had seen. Dangerous weapons, it just sort of sets out the types of dangerous weapons that were noted within the dockets. You can see quite a lot of firearms there, 20%, so one out of five cases involved a firearm. Weapons were seized in or used in 50% of our cases, but only seized in 5% of cases. All of the cases that were firearm-related, no seizures are being made. We also have a problem which we're trying to negotiate and have conversations about, and I think we need to continue conversations about, and that's the issue of the removal of firearms from police who commit acts of domestic violence. We see many, many of those cases in the Western Cape, and they're still simply unresolved. We've had a number of reasons why firearms can't be removed. I think they're quite legitimate, but I think there's a degree of flexibility, and I think we could be slightly more creative than bringing service pistols back home into a domestic context. The other thing that really stands out to me is that we really have a lack of awareness, social context awareness of the nature of cases that are coming through. And the women that we had interviewed, and about 800 of them that we spoke to, 21% were threatened with death by their abusive partners if they returned to court or withdrew charges. So there's substantive scientific evidence that suggests that a lot of complainants do not return, not because of willy-nilly reasons, because of really quite critical concerns about their own safety. In a further 26% of cases, women were threatened with gang rape or gang retaliation or some other retaliation. In some instances, the abuse just got worse. They feared coming back. Children were kidnapped. There was threats to burn down houses. They were threatened with sexual assault. So there's a whole range of reasons why women don't return to the courts or withdraw charges, but we need to really critically as police figure out what those reasons are, and we need to find a way to act on them. And again, I think we need to spend a lot of time and a lot of training attention on the intersection between the Sexual Offences Act, the Domestic Violence Act, and the Children's Act. They do intersect. We need to talk about how we manage families, not the adult sexual assault survivor, not the adult domestic violence survivor, but how we deal with the entire family, where a child is sexually violated in a domestic context, or an adult is a victim of domestic violence but is in care of children. There's so many different pieces of legislation that we can use in a very functional, straightforward way, but we're not having those conversations about the connections between all of the pieces of legislation. The other thing that I get all the time is, yeah, but women abuse the system, and that's why I don't lay criminal charges, that's why I don't open dockets. I think I have about a minute and a half left, so I am on my last slide, Chair. And what we've learned over the years that, and I'm using women because they are most of the people that we come into contact with in our work, but that they strategically use parts of the system. there is nothing wrong or illegal about laying a criminal charge and withdrawing it because you fear for your safety or you can't continue for some reason. There's nothing wrong with not showing up on the return date to finalize your protection order. Sometimes just laying the charge or just going to the court sufficiently deals with what they're experiencing with that home. And in fact, it's a labor on the system, as some women continue when things have been resolved in alternative ways in some instances. A lot of women have told us that it was resolved, you got a fight. We had conversations that we never had before. We've used other remedies. I need to withdraw. Why punish complainants for not proceeding? At the same time, with that said, we also need to examine the reasons why they do withdraw these cases. And sometimes it's systemic. Protection orders are not served in many cases. Someone are told to serve their own protection order or to flag down a patrol van and ask them to serve it. Or, you know, where there is service, it's served on the complainant themselves and then they have to serve it onto the respondent. So there's a lot of systemic issues that are, you know, kind of contributing to the reasons why we have this high rate of attrition. And in our training and our policies and our the ways we manage these cases, we need to acknowledge that that's a really serious social context in which complainants engage with the system. I'm going to leave it at that. I have a couple of very brief conclusions. One is that I'm not terribly surprised that there's limited compliance to the national instructions in detail, because I personally think they're very cumbersome, and they're far too detailed. I think they could be simplified. I think we could come up with an effective, brief, manageable, feasible policy, a checklist in which certain duties can be complied with, and the rest we leave up to good professional policing conduct. I think they're overwhelming, and if I was given a 40-page national instruction, I'm not sure if I would want to open up a docket either. The second is that the domestic violence, the SAP 508Bs, the incidents reports, are also very confusing. They're very difficult to fill out. We have provided some recommendations of how those can change, but they are very lengthy. I think they should be tick boxes. And, you know, there's information about medical care and important stuff there, but it's difficult to differentiate whether you're talking about incidents from the past or the current incident. It's a very confusing form, and it needs to be cleaned up, and it needs to be something that police can fill out quickly and effectively, because they're important, and those need to be put in the dockets. I also think we need to, again, think very carefully about the nexus of the different types of legislation. I think this system and the laws and the way they've been constructed results that we treat women separately from their children. And in fact, domestic violence involves a wide family context, and we need to know how to manage those within a policing context. And my last word is about the trauma rooms. Many, many years ago, we were involved in getting trauma rooms set up in the Western Cape, and I go back periodically. And yes, they do exist, but the condition of these rooms is absolutely shocking. There's no lighting, the windows are broken, there's no heating in the winter, there's no air conditioning in the summer, there's one chair, or they're geared for children. You don't stick an adult sexual assault survivor in a room full of teddy bears. It's just totally inappropriate, and I think we need to look at who our client base is, who's coming in, who's going to use the trauma room, because it's not just domestic violence and sexual assault survivors. It's survivors of car accidents, of witnesses of other crimes. You know, we need to think about who our target audience is then. We need to construct these spaces so that they look professional. So when people walk in, they feel like they're being taken care of in a professional space that's not targeted at three-year-olds. Okay, so I do recognize that they do exist, but I also think we need to take a very close look at the condition and the state of some of these rooms. You know, before we see that as a victory. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Lillian Arts. Honorable Chair, we thank you. Those were the three presentations from civil society organizations. In addition to the three presentations, we have extra copies of the Women's Legal Center document. We have in our packs a report from RAPCAN. We also have in our packs research that was done by the Women's Legal Center on police abuse of sex workers. We thank you very much for availing this opportunity for us to come and present. And on that note, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much for
for the presentation. I think we needed to hear many of these things that have been said here in this meeting. I will now allow members to ask questions. Tea will be ready at 12, so I think we may proceed and probably take a short break at 12 and come back to continue with our interaction. We will take hands from members. Honorable Kolapana, Honorable NG, Honorable Swate, Honorable Annelies, Honorable Lekgetho, Honorable Ramatlakane, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Certainly, we have watched for years as the SAPS has treated the ICD with contempt. I say that without fear of contradiction. Now, what we see here is where the ICD refers to disciplinary actions. I'd like to know how many members have been disciplined, not only how many members have been disciplined for non-compliance in relation to the 236 complaints against police, but more importantly, how many station heads have been reported for disciplinary action because these stations do not comply? That's where the buck should stop, with the head of the station. And somehow we're looking and targeting individuals within the station who in many instances, bearing in mind they train two people a station maybe once in 6 months. So you're never going to have a situation where everyone in the station is trained. So it may well be ignorance on their part, but certainly the buck stops with the head of the station. And I would like to know how many of them have been hauled up for disciplinary in this regard. SAPS on page 4, I wasn't too sure about that slide. Is this the total number of complaints received nationally in January last year and then February last year? I don't know. I don't know why we would have such figures. I found that quite confusing. Pardon? First 6 months, second 6 months. There's no relation at all. None. For the same period to the 113 cases detailed by the ICD. So how is it you've got a handful and the ICD have got over 100 for that particular time frame? I do not understand how this can happen, and I would like an explanation for that. And then SAPS on page 12, your heading, the establishment of FCS units. That surely should read the re-establishment of FCS units, because of course you closed them all down on the order of the previous National Police Commissioner, Jackie Salebi, and we saw the huge increase in women and child-related crime and the huge drop in convictions as a result. So, how many FCS units did you have nationally prior to that order? That in relation to the 176 you have now recreated. Are we back up to a full complement in every province? Have you re-employed those FCS experts who were cast aside? We had reports of them working out of broom cupboards, going out on cases not in any way related to the areas of expertise. Have you scooped that expertise back into these units? And please explain to me, how is it possible you can have 12,048 arrests and just 529 convictions? That is the convictions against the children, 595 against the adults. That's 1,000 convictions out of 12,000 arrests, 1 in 12. Of those arrested, and you cannot tell me there are not thousands and thousands who are not arrested. So I find that figure really a disgrace, and I would like an explanation. And as we were reminded by Lisa Vetten, when the police fail to keep their domestic violence records, as we have seen time and time and time again at every station we go to, the implications are there in relation to the Firearm Control Act. If one appears in a domestic violence register, one should be refused a license, but because of the failure on the part of SAPS, we might well find that men who batter their wives are being granted licenses. So I haven't been able to find those statistics anywhere in these documents. so I'd appreciate it if you'd give them to me. Where are these records detailed? Where people should have been put into the domestic violence registers, have not, and as a result have been given firearm licenses. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My question is on the FCS members training. Mr. Heldenis, you said on the 1,896 members, of them 1,536 have already undergone the training. This ties up with what Mrs. Mbuli said about the lack of understanding of SAPS members of DVA. My question is, what is wrong there? Is it the training that is not adequate? What is wrong? Because this number that you gave is a big chunk, but when you get to the FCS and all over, you don't see it happening that these people are really trained. My question is, what is wrong? Is it the training, or what is going wrong? Other part of the question is to Mr. Mutiba about your visits, the full compliance visits. You even said you put in place some corrective actions. Now, what I want to know is, after putting in these corrective actions, do you make follow-ups to check if they are being attached to, or you just put them and hope something happens? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've got a question on slide number 21 on SAPS, the challenge. The challenge is domestic violence. It is actually stated here that victims are electing to withdraw charges for various reasons. So I find it very strange, because I just need them to explain further on that one, because it might not be only economic dependence. It might also be something coming from them not actually treating those people very well in those stations. So I need them actually to elaborate further on that one. I'm not satisfied with only economic dependency. And my other question is with regard to ICD on slide number 9. They indicated that in terms of non-compliance with DVA, they indicated the failure to arrest the abusers of violence that they have committed. So they indicated that 30% of those people who are actually involved. So I just want to find out if that 30% is only that number, or is it more? Or if that is more, why is this happening? And also, I've got another question with for Limpopo Legal Advice Center. They indicated that they are actually based in Limpopo, and they said that most of the incidents that actually are violence related are actually reported to rural police stations, but it seems some police stations in the rural areas are actually not taking those cases, are referring those people to the traditional leaders or the chiefs or the royal crowns. So I just want for him to give us maybe the number of those police stations and where are those police stations are located, because I also come from Limpopo. Maybe I could also have a chance to go around and check all those police stations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, here's a couple of questions. You know, today we're having women's debate
joint sitting again this afternoon. And if you think about the fact that this legislation has been in place forever and a day, and the fact that we're still struggling, it really is demotivating, to say the least. You know, a month ago, the ICD, the department, and the National Prosecuting Authority was with, two months ago, with the department, with the Committee on Justice, on the same issue, and including the Child Justice Act. And what worries me, Chairperson, is that despite what happened at that meeting, and it wasn't a very nice meeting for those who were there, it was quite a negative meeting in terms of the acceptance of the work that has been done by the Committee on Justice. In fact, they alerted me to it last night again, the Chairperson and member from the ACDP. Despite that, we come to a meeting today, and again, such figures and the ICD figures are not talking to one another. You have ICD reporting on 2 years, which I don't understand either. 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. You have the SAPD reporting on 1 year, 6 months, 6 months. The figures differ completely. Honourable Kula Barnard has alerted that. But you look at the figures, differ completely. According to SAFSA, they have so many complaints. According to the ICD, they have so many complaints. Who do we believe? Where do we start? And this is not the first time it happens. You go back on the meetings of this committee and you will see it's been there every single time. SAFSA figures differ from the ICD figures. There's a joint responsibility here. And surely getting together and sorting out those figures before you come to Parliament and waste our time should be part of that. Tim, I want to thank you for granting the NGOs and the research institutions the opportunity to present today. Because we sit here, people go back to the head office, offices, and they go and they don't think we know it, and they say, ish, but Parliament complains, but Parliament doesn't know what the hell it's talking about. It's just Parliament complaining. We get those messages back. Some of your colleagues actually tell us that. So for once, you've heard it from other people as well. I want an explanation why SAPS and the ICD figures differ. I want an explanation. A clear explanation why it differs. Why Mr. Geldenhuys from Legal Services give us one figure, 13, ICD's figure for that same period is less than that, that's 54, ICD's figure. Sorry, I lost my reading glasses so I can't see. 54. Then it gives us 23, ICD figure for that same period is 59. And you know, Mr. Geldenhuys, that we've raised this issue before. We've raised this issue before. One of those meetings was in S15, where we've raised this issue, where this committee actually chased the department at the ICD away and said, go and sort out these figures. Chairperson, there's a legal requirement. The chair has read it. That the ICD and the department must report on these figures to Parliament. A legal requirement. We weren't even part of drafting this legislation. That requirement was put there by the Department of Justice, by the Committee of Justice, on these two institutions to report it to us. But 15 years later, they still don't take it serious. I would like to know from the ICD, those stations that you found 100% compliant, please provide us the names. If you can't do so today, then come back in writing for all those periods, the 100% compliance. I doubt that very, very much. But I want to see them, and if it's there, good, because then they can be used as best practices by other police stations. So let us please receive those. In fact, Chairperson, I think we should receive the list of all those for every single percentage so that we can look at them. It will also be interesting for us to compare them with our own findings at stations. This weekend you read the Sunday Times. In it is a lady who has laid a charge, opened a case of domestic violence with SAPS, indicating to SAPS that her boyfriend or her partner abuses her and that he's got a weapon. Now, reflected in the figures also from the NGOs and the research institutions, SAPS didn't bother to take off this man's weapon. So it happened again. She wakes up, he's sitting on top of her, he's hitting her left, right and center. She feels the firearm at the back of his body, shoots him. Now this lady is 3 or 4 years later, is facing an inquest by SAPS. If I'm this lady, I would sue SAPS. I would sue SAPS. I'll just be one of the many that does. Because you failed to take the man's firearm. Chairperson, the part of the problem is that SAPS is looking at the Domestic Violence Act, and I can pretty much assure you that the Child Justice Act and the Sexual Offences Act as administrative burdens. They're not looking at it as a crime investigating tool, which it is. It's a tool for you to establish that somebody, man or woman, is violent in nature. Let's not grant him a firearm license. And we don't bother. We don't bother. We could put in place, Chairperson, regulations to say that the firearms, the designated firearm officer, have got to sign next to the register if he has inspected it for an application. It's not going to make a difference because the registers are not up to date. That's part of the problem that we are facing. And for me, there's no excuse anymore. You can't have excuses 15 years after the fact. We've asked SAPS, year in, year out, we've asked SAPS, come and tell us what is the problem with the legislation so that we can change the legislation so that it's better implementable. Not one single suggestion. Not one. We've asked the ICD, tell us, what is your experience, where is the problem, what is the problem, where must we change the legislation so that SAPS can implement it properly. Not one recommendation. Jefferson, I've got so many questions, but really, I don't even know whether it's worth asking these questions because you don't know whether you're going to get the truth in terms of answers. The training opportunities for DVA, year in, year out. There was, in fact, I would ask the committee secretary to check this with the previous committee secretary and go back to our notes. There was a year that we were told that every single member in SAPS have now been trained on the Domestic Violence Act. Every single person in SAPS have now been trained on the Domestic Violence Act. It's not that long ago. I think it was about 3 years ago that we were told that. Now, I challenge you, even on these figures, just from the visit we've just come to, we've been to stations where we've heard that nobody has been trained on the Domestic Violence Act. And I also agree with the research institutions. It's not only training, it's about what you are training the officers to do. Yeah, I really don't know. Is it time that we don't accept these reports as a committee? What do we do? We need to take a drastic decision around this. Do we report to Parliament that this Act is failing and that we've got to relook this Act? I must also ask Chairperson, where's the ICD's 6 month report for this year? Because we're already in the month of August. You were already supposed to have submitted to us the first 6 months report. Every 6 months, Mr. Beerman, every 6 months. Legislation's clear about it. Chairperson, I do believe also that we have a challenge in terms of not a challenge. I think we've When we've applied our minds, when we said that we're going to remove the DVA from the ICD to the Secretariat. Part of the reason for that is the Secretariat's ability to make recommendations and policy adjustments as well. But I do think it is necessary for us as a committee to some point. I see Millie and people from the Secretariat is here, but at some point in time for us to call specifically the Monitoring and Evaluation Unit to the committee and to hear how they intend dealing with that obligation that we've now added to their responsibilities and how they intend enriching the reports, but also the actions of SAPS. Jerry, last question. I see from the ICD that there are many, many cases we are still waiting for SAPS for reaction. Some of it's 2 years and longer. Well, 2 years, because we've got the 2 years, but I'm pretty sure if you go back, it will be longer. We've got 2 years report here. I want to know from the ICD, what have you done other than reporting to us that you're still waiting for it to get that from the SAPS? But I also want to know from the police, why does it take 2 years for you to do something about it? You don't comply to the Act. Why should the ordinary citizens be law-abiding?
Thank you, Chair. Let me take this opportunity also to thank the presenters. To the ICD, you have reported that you are visiting various police stations and audit them. You said for January, June 2009, you visited about 280 police stations, 177 2010. But to me, the numbers are not enough to me. Maybe I'll be happy, like the honorable member here, analyst, saying that you must provide with a list. But not only of those who have complied, but all the stations that you have visited. I am saying this because we have been visiting various stations throughout the country. Like the Honorable Chair said earlier on, that we are from different provinces. I haven't seen your signature, your stamp, anywhere else in the documents that we're inspecting, that you have passed there. So it is important for me to have a list of all those stations that you visited. The other issue is, to me, it will be important that when, as ICD, you visit the stations, you sign elsewhere. But your signature to me would be very important to know that you visited that area. Not for you to come here and tell me that you, when we are there, we must see all these things that the ICT was here. And we become happy. But recently in Winterfeld, we were asking, who signed here to the manager in the CFC? He said, I don't know. He cannot even read. And it's just a signature with no name, nothing else. What are you signing when the register is not up to date? There is nothing in the domestic violence register. You can't read it. But this person continues to sign with a red pen. He doesn't write down his name so that we cannot trace him. So to me, it will be important that as you go around various stations, we must see that you were there, because we want to make follow-ups. the issue of completing the domestic violence register is very, very important when we issue firearms licenses. That cannot be overemphasized. It's very, very, very important that you need to go back and check that these registers are very, very important, updated, because people that we give licenses, the other presenter has just said that about 50% of women abuse is through firearms. And I want to agree that most probably this 50% they are talking to, I think the University of, yes. Let me just get the name of the, yes, the university that has just presented of Cape Town. That 50% of this abuse are through firearms. And I want to agree that these firearms get through because they are not linked to the domestic violence register. If these people, the register is updated, then you would say we cannot give you the firearm license because we definitely you want it for this particular, but they go just like that. Lastly, Chair, the issue of police in Limpopo referring victims of abuse to the traditional authorities cannot be left unattended. I think we need to condemn that the police must not abdicate their responsibilities. And in this regard, I think we need to get more information. Who in particular is doing this? Which station? Thanks.
Well, thank you, Honorable Chair. I have a few questions. Maybe let me just start with the traditional authorities and Limpopo. It seems to hear the presenter saying that the action of the traditional authority at the end after they've had they impose sanctions in the form of fines to the victims. I just want to get a clarity what that means. Does it mean the traditional authority convene a court and of course punish both the victim and of course the one that in fact the perpetrator? I don't seem to understand this, because the crime in itself is a crime that is in fact defined in the law. So if you can maybe just help me to understand that. Second question I just want to ask is a general police question. And I see in the page 14 around the issues of the conviction rate and the numbers and the reported. I want to just understand the reason of this kind of slowness in terms of conviction. If you look at the numbers of arrests that has been taken place, is there integrated approach between the police and of course the other agencies like the prosecutors in order to address this particular problem when dealing with the kind of cases like this? Is there an integrated approach in dealing with this particular problem? Because if it's only about 1,000, you're looking at a problem, and what is that reason of the slowness in it? I see in the report you also mentioned you have a time frame of 2014 for the trauma room that or the victim support centers, that only then will you have them in the police station. And I see you've got only 799 so far. Now, when you deal with this particular crime, particularly abuse, domestic violence, you're probably dealing with a quite sensitive crime. And only not sensitive, but a crime that requires quite of approach and management and environment that is accommodating. Now, if you don't have them, and of course the second trauma then get visited to the victims when they report the crime itself. So if you don't have a victim support centers, what do you then use as an infrastructure? What is it that you use at the police station or the CSC to deal with this particular problem? What space do you use for counseling? What is it that you use? And why must it be 2014? It strikes me as a big problem. You may find that the problem that you have, you may find the withdrawal environment that is not conducive for people to come back at the stations, being that one that actually makes sure that people have been victimized twice and therefore they take a particular route to say, I'd rather not come back here, the environment is just not good enough. Now, is there no other shortened program in addressing this particular question? Now, the third one is what is the problem of building a relationship between the NGO and the police around that deals with this particular aspect of domestic violence in particular? I can't understand what it is, what is the problem, because I think the NGO sector is actually, they play a complementary role in terms of assisting the police. What is the resistance? Why is such a resistance in terms of assistance? While I'm on the NGO and dealing with that, I didn't quite hear this part coming out in terms of the NGO sector role in terms of what is it that we can do in terms of this partnership building moving forward around the particular domestic violence, the issue about infrastructural problem at the police station. I hear the conditions, but I didn't quite hear what is it that we could come forward as an NGO sector to say, particularly around the issues of infrastructure, the conduciveness of that infrastructure, this is the role and this is the contribution we could make to make this environment much more conducive. So I'm asking that question that what is it that we can do in a partnership? Because that didn't come out quite clear. Now, the last is also dealing with the police. Is there no other plans that you can deal with this particular problem? I hear and I see the report about the withdrawal of cases and all that, or people not coming forward. You know, the most places that has a volume of people who are crying out for help, particularly over weekend, you'd find trauma, the outpatients at the hospital in various places, where you find problem of people that have been abused. But you don't find that environment where you can see any police, and I'm not talking of police with a uniform, that can help, including addressing that particular issue when it's fresh. You wait for somebody mandate for a person to come forward. Is there no plan, proactive plan, that can be put in place to deal with that particular question? I've self certainly seen over weekend at the hospital, I've certainly seen the number of abused people who are abused sitting there bleeding, but you don't see infrastructure that help those victims at that particular level. Of course, the police station is farther down the road. Now, what is the plan that you can address that? Because I think that's a big problem that you have. And I'm asking these questions mindful and understanding the difficulty and the challenging of the crime that we're dealing with, particularly the issue about relationship, a family relationship, because it is a difficult species of crime. So I'm asking this question understanding very well that it does happen, that cases are withdrawn because of the relationship of family. Hence, there was a debate before about at that level, what does the state do in terms of taking over that particular complaint? So, but I want to say that I understand fully. I'm not asking this question without understanding the complexity of it. But something can be done in terms of dealing with this particular question. Particularly, I'm worried about the firearm issue and the issue that poor record keeping in terms of the incident and people who has in fact cases of protection order against who there's no correlation. You're unable to see the application and the crime, and actually there is an order against this particular person. Therefore, the incompetency of carrying a firearm does not become an issue to begin to raise the red flag, and then the firearm license is awarded, is given, without necessarily comparing that. It's actually a serious problem that if not addressed, it will continue to run the risk of firearm as a weapon of choice for people in terms of this, what is happening in terms of, you look at the report, 20% of that weapon of crime has been committed, that particular crime by weapon. So that may well be, if you look at it, that those number, there's been a repeat of those, or those people have been having order against them, but the right hand did not understand what the left hand was doing, and they awarded the firearm license, that it resulted into fatalities of that nature, not only just the incident, but fatalities. That's my questions. The ICD question has already been posed. And I'm worried about the 5,000 training, I must just say, of the competency level compared to 190,000. I mean, it's never going to happen. It's not going to finish. And I mean, unless you say that's the only officials that are competent and that are dealing with that particular crime across the country, but I think it's not. That's not the case. The CSC deals with this particular question. But if you look at the capacity of it in terms of training, and in fact, if you look, you read the slide, how it's written, it says that the new recruits are the part of the module is this particular act. It deals with the new recruits, but the problem is not the new recruits. The problem is the current SEPS personnel. Where will they lack capacity? Not the trainers, not the recruits, the real functional police. That's where the problem is. So it's a fudge, this written slides that we're focusing on that. It actually has to say functional police that are ready on the ground, on the field. What is the plan to address this particular challenge in terms of their own capacity, training capacity? The way of 250 that is mentioned here, the figure, is a drop in the ocean, comparatively speaking to the problem that you're encountering on a daily basis. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, members, for questions. SAPS, well, maybe before I go to SAPS, I think it's the University of Cape Town presentation. I just want to check with the... According to your presentation, you interviewed 503 DVE applicants via Mosaic Crowd Support. I'm interested to know the composition of the sample. Is it rural people, urban people, or a mixture of that, so that maybe from these responses that you've given us, we probably can then have a better understanding. If you explain that, I'm sorry, but I think I did not understand it. So just an explanation to that effect. Going to SAPS, my question will be, have you submitted 6 monthly reports? And what proof can you give us, because we can't trace them in Parliament? Where are they? How many have you submitted?
from the implementation of this time, in fact, when it was implemented, as per the Act itself. That does not give you an option not to submit. Coming to SAPS again, SAPS, you are telling us about the training that you have offered and probably the effect thereof, which you are saying you think it is, the decrease is because of the training that you have offered to your members. My question will be to say, as part of your management, and not depending, in fact, management responsibilities, and not depending on what the ICD is doing as per the Act, but as part of your management responsibilities, and of course as part of your tool to evaluate the effectiveness of this training you're talking about, how have you monitored the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act? And where? And where are the reports? Coming to the issues related to disciplinary processes that must unfold in the event of non-compliance, can the South African Defence, South African Police Service members present here, explain exactly as to what should happen when this is reported? What then do you do up to the end? And what have you been doing? And at what stage do we have a case reported and 2 years later nothing has happened? There's no feedback. What actually happens in practical situation? Why is it happening? Probably another question I will have, it will be my little bit of concern to ICD. And I think it goes to the comment being made by, I think, Mbuli, or yes, the lady there. She says, I quote, "The purpose of our visit is not to name and shame the police, but to encourage them to improve." I think I have a little bit of a challenge with that statement, because I would have thought that your visiting to police station is informed by the Act itself. So you are complying with the Act, and you are expecting SAPS to be complying with the Act. It's not about shaming, it's not even about improving. It's about ensuring that SAPS comply, not with the bill, not with just the policy that is somewhere there, but the Act itself. And I think that is rather too soft, and probably that is why the SAPS is not taking your recommendation seriously. Maybe because they are a little bit apologetic when you raise these issues. I also, just on the case of SAPS, I think it was page 7, if I'm not mistaken. In fact, it is ICD. I was just trying to check applications for exemptions and versus overview intake versus application for exemptions. There are these figures. I could not understand. I don't understand it. How do you come to these figures, if you can explain that to me? And maybe to start as well on your on page 3, domestic violence reports. I don't want to first state that I wouldn't believe, not even in 100 years, that these numbers or these figures are correct, because police stations that we've visited tell us one thing and one thing only, that domestic violence records are not properly done. Whether you're talking about domestic violence register or protection orders or anything for that matter, these are just not properly done. But I'm just reading what is here as to whether really we believe that this could actually be the correct figures. Number of cases reported involving domestic violence, January to June, Gauteng, 12,362. July to December 2010, 12,876. I think we have research people here who probably will, researchers here who probably will assist us really to say, is this, what informs this? Something will probably trigger more violence at a particular time? Is it December time, maybe because people are at home, are drunk, and so on? Is it Easter time because this and that? You know, there will be some relationship between a particular figure and this. Is it July to whatever? What is informing these figures to be like this? Western Cape, January to June, 11,211. July to December, 11,122, difference of 89. AZN, January to June, 6,971. July, December, 6,408. Free State, January to June, 5,288. July, December, 5,532. Eastern Cape, January to June, 5,289. July, December, 5,697. Mpumalanga, January to June, 2,562. July to December, 2,520, difference of 20, of 42. Northwest, January to June, 2,414. July to December, 2,415, a difference of 1. What is this? Limpopo, January to June, 2,299, July to December, 2,336, difference of 37. Northern Cape, January to June, 1,818, July to December, 1,735, difference of 83. The total, January to June, 50,214, July to December, 50,663. I'm just asking these figures to say, when you receive this information as SAPS HQ, what do you do? When you get figures such as this, and you think you must table them before Parliament, so that people out there can access these figures and regard them as the information that was brought to Parliament and therefore supposed to be very reliable. What do you do? I'm really asking, what do we do? Must we really believe that Northwest will have a difference of one case in two terms? I'm just asking, what would inform these figures to be so similar, so almost the same? I'm asking. And this is in Parliament, and from here it can actually go out to everybody as a very reliable information. I'm asking if SAPS could actually tell us as to whether really must we believe that these figures are correct. If you go to police stations today, their figures are not the same. They're not the same every week. They're not the same every month. They're not the same every year. But the information that is here is actually saying, no, you're getting almost one and the same information from each and every province. Sometimes you even wonder as to whether it is really true that province so and so will have so few domestic violence cases. You just don't understand. But I'm just asking, this information is tabled before Parliament, and therefore it's regarded as the correct information. Is it really correct? There is tea outside. We will break for 10 minutes. And please let's start here at 12:30 and allow some responses to come. Thank you.
environmental conditions. Thank you very much.